Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Shireen Stanford. Seth Miller is the executive director of the Innocence Project of Florida, a nonprofit that aims to free wrongfully convicted and incarcerated people. He is also the president of the Innocence Network, a collection of more than 70 innocence organizations around the world. Miller previously served as an attorney with the American Bar Association Death Penalty Moratorium Implementation Project and with the First District Court of Appeal in Tallahassee, Florida. He graduated from Florida State University College of Law and received his undergraduate degree from Penn State. Seth Miller, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Shireen. Happy to be here.
So innocence projects have primarily focused on exoneration through DNA testing. Some still do, but the Innocence Project of Florida has also expanded beyond that. Can you talk about that evolution and why that was important?
There have been now over 350 individuals who were wrongfully convicted and exonerated through DNA testing. But actually, most of the people who have been exonerated in this country since 1989, in their cases, DNA wasn't a component. So for many years, we just focused on DNA testing cases, and that was largely a resource issue. It's a little easier to get at the question of innocence in DNA cases. But as time has gone on and DNA testing has been more prevalent at the pretrial stage of criminal cases, it made sense that we move on to a broader group of cases beyond DNA, because after all, the same things that cause wrongful convictions in cases that can be solved through DNA testing cause them in all other cases.
And what are some of the reasons why people are convicted of crimes they didn't commit?
There's all kinds of reasons for why people get convicted of crimes that they're innocent of. We are lucky that because we have this huge data set of exonerations, we can go back and try to figure out why those folks got wrongfully convicted and try to establish mechanisms for fixing those things that cause wrongful convictions. So clearly, eyewitness misidentification is the leading cause of wrongful convictions. It happens in about 70% of innocence cases. False confessions are a huge cause of wrongful convictions, about 1 in 4 of the whole set of exoneree cases. There was a false confession. Bad forensic science and junk science cause wrongful convictions. Bad defense lawyering is a huge problem, particularly in the indigent defense system, where well-meaning lawyers just aren't resourced well to be able to handle their crushing caseloads, which leads to just inadequate defense. And prosecutorial misconduct is a huge problem as well, hiding evidence, presenting false testimony, and the like. All these things happen. One or more happen in lots of different cases. It can be a combination thereof. So there's a number of causes, and we're lucky that we're able to try to figure them out and prevent them from happening in the future.
So, you know, one of those that you mentioned were false confessions. And, you know, research shows that our memories are actually very malleable. And scientists like psychologist Julia Shaw have shown how easy it is to implant false memories, to even get people to admit to things in great detail that they've never done. But what implications does this kind of research have for the work that you do?
Well, I think the first thing in all of this is recognition by the entire criminal justice system that false confessions can happen, that people do confess to things that they didn't do, that they're completely innocent of. And that is something that the criminal justice system hasn't really come to terms with yet. I think you're right that social scientists have known this for many years. But oftentimes, when you're asking a law enforcement group or individuals to change the way they do interrogations to try to make them designed to actually get at true information as opposed to false information, they're sometimes reticent to do that, particularly when you're telling them the social science says this or that. And they're like, well, I've been getting confessions my whole career. Why would I care about what some social scientist says? So I think getting folks within the law enforcement community to be more accepting of sound scientific research that can help them do their jobs better, help them get to the right results, is really the first thing that we need to do. Because false confessions are a real thing. We know this from DNA exonerations, and we have to try to figure out ways to do interrogations in a way that don't send the wrong people to prison.
So in addition to trying to get people exonerated, the Innocence Project of Florida also works to affect legislation to reform the criminal justice system. Florida recently enacted a law implementing some best practices for eyewitness lineups. For example, that the people conducting the lineups should not know who's considered a suspect. How will this law help affect wrongful convictions?
We're really lucky in Florida, and we're one of over 25 states that has enacted an eyewitness identification reform law just recently. And our law requires double-blind administration of lineups, which means that we're going to use an independent administrator who doesn't know who the suspect is to administer a live lineup or a photo lineup. And the reason this is important is because if they don't know who the suspect is and whether they're in the lineup or not, it takes away their ability, either intentionally or unintentionally, to give cues to the eyewitness while they're looking at a photo lineup or a live lineup that can taint their ability to make an accurate identification, can oftentimes lead to identifying the wrong person. And so this is just like drug trials or any other scientific test where we always use double-blind administration. And if law enforcement and people within the criminal justice system think of eyewitness lineups not as a police function but as a scientific test of the eyewitness's memory, it makes sense to apply scientific principles to that to get to reliable results.
And one of the other things that's a part of that law is that people should be told that the suspect could not be in the lineup as well. Why is that important?
Yeah, so one of the best practices that has come out of the social scientific research is every eyewitness needs to be told the suspect may or may not be in the lineup. And this is really important because it takes a little pressure off the eyewitness so they don't feel that they have to make an identification if they don't see or if they're not sure that the person is in the lineup. I mean, you think about the situation. You're in a room with law enforcement officers. Maybe you're a victim. You want to help. And if there's pressure on you to pick, even if you're not sure, it's almost certainly going to lead to a misidentification, at least, or a wrongful conviction. So that kind of instruction takes that pressure off and is going to lead to more reliable results.
What other reforms would you like to see within the criminal justice system?
Well, you had mentioned false confessions is a huge problem, and one way to root out false confessions is to do something very simple, and that's to record the entirety of interrogations. Right now, even today, most recording done during witness interviewing is just done during the confession. All we see is the product, the end result of an interrogation, but we don't know what the nature of that interrogation was to be able to use that information to judge the reliability of the confession. So it's important that we tape the entirety of interrogations because then we can see, has there been coercion? Has this person buckled under pressure and maybe given false information that can help us judge the reliability and accuracy of a confession so we can root it out before it taints a criminal trial?
And interestingly, I mean, you have to work within this criminal justice system that you're working to reform because you think it has some flaws. Do you have faith in our current system?
I have faith that we're going to do everything we can to work with the people in this criminal justice system to make it more reliable. I don't worry about whether it is perfect now or was perfect before or can be perfect because we know it's not perfect and it's never going to be perfect. But the idea is to recognize when we have problems, identify them, and do whatever we can to fix them. We are moving into a period, I think, after almost 25, 30 years of successful innocence work where we're really starting to see a recognition on the part of all the other stakeholders in the criminal justice system that this is a real problem and that we can, there are really simple things that we can do that are consensus best practices to, you know, try to prevent wrongful convictions before they happen, some of the things we've already talked about. And we're seeing it with international and national law enforcement organizations, prosecutorial organizations are getting behind these reforms because they understand that ultimately it's about getting the right person and it's going to help them do their jobs better, which ultimately helps all of society.
And your organization gets many more requests than you can possibly take. I've seen you quote, you know, about 1,000, you can get up to 1,000 or so requests per year, but you can probably take about 10 or so. How difficult is the process of making those selections and ultimately knowing that you're, you know, rejecting some others?
Yeah, so when you have maybe 1,000 people writing you letters, their family members sending you emails, their family members calling, leaving Facebook messages on your organizational Facebook, all of them are desperate. And you understand that because when you're locked up and separated from society, whether you're innocent or guilty, it's a terrible thing for people and their families. And so we understand where we are in the criminal justice system, which is in many respects we're the last people who might help any person. And so that means that we have to apply a stringent lens to our review of these cases because we can only take about 1% of them and we only want to take ones that we have a really high probability of success. But we want to give every one of them a really good look so that when we reject someone, we know that it's because we can't help them because if we can, we would really like to.
So one of the most well-known cases that you've taken on is that of James Bain. Can you tell us his story?
James was convicted of raping a little boy in Polk County, Florida in 1974. He was 19 years old at that time. And the story, when you look at all of the wrongful conviction cases, it's, you know, not all that extraordinary. But for 1974, it was certainly interesting. And in his case, little boy was released by the perpetrator and he went home and his family was there with the law enforcement waiting for him. And they said, "What happened to you? Describe who did this to you." And he described a young man, and his uncle, incidentally, was the assistant principal at the local high school. And he said, "Oh, that sounds like a former student of mine named James Bain." And so he went to the school and got a photo of James Bain. It was a color photo, a school photo. He's looking nice in his school clothes. And they showed that to this young boy in a photo lineup of a bunch of black and white mugshots of other people. And so it stuck out. And they asked the boy not, "Do you see the person who committed the crime against you?" But they asked him, "Do you see Jimmy Bain?" And of course, the little boy knew at that point that, you know, this is the picture that his uncle got. And he picked that color picture. And off we were, hurtling towards a wrongful conviction. And he was convicted based on that eyewitness evidence. With an all-white jury, no other evidence to connect him to the crime. And he was sentenced to life in prison, to be separated from his family, to die there. And for many years, he just languished. You know, we came about 35 years after he was convicted and were able to procure DNA testing in his case of the victim's underwear, which had biological evidence from the perpetrator on it. And lo and behold, even 35 years later, this shows the power of DNA. We were able to get a result that showed that that biological material didn't belong to James Bain, but belonged to some unknown person who was the perpetrator of this crime. And so shortly after us taking on the case, 8 months later, James Bain was a free man after 35 years of wrongful incarceration.
I was really struck by the photos of him, the mugshot when he went in at 19, and then what he looked like at, you know, 54. And, you know, there's a video of him using a cell phone for the first time on the steps of the courthouse. And, I mean, it's a different world. How do you help people reintegrate into a society that's can be very different than when they went in?
It is incredibly difficult to re-enter society many times decades later when it's completely different than the world that you left all that time before. And so we would expect that these men and women who are exonerated would have struggles. And our job at the Innocence Project of Florida and at many other organizations like ours is to try to do whatever we can to make sure that that reintegration goes as smoothly as possible. So many organizations have social services programs, mine does, that helps with job training and healthcare and, you know, intellectual healthcare, all kinds of other services that the person would need in order to make sure that they can lead a stable life that is going to be fruitful for them and allow them to be a productive member of society. We'll also try to get them compensated because we all know that having money isn't the answer to everything, but it can take a lot of stress out of life and allow that can cause problems. And so, you know, we want these guys, these women who have lost so much and are trying to regain their life back to be able to enjoy the time they have left on earth and make it as fruitful for them as possible.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Shireen Stanford. Our guest is Seth Miller, Executive Director of the Innocence Project of Florida and President of the Innocence Network. When I read the cases, and you have some of them on your website, and the results at the end are, they're happy ending. I mean, they're good, but for some reason it feels a little bittersweet. What is that feeling like when you get what's considered a victory, but obviously this person's been locked away for a while?
We always say that our clients are the most fortunate, unfortunate people around, right? We would prefer them not to have had an exoneration because we would prefer them not to have needed it. And so certainly the moment where we get a man or a woman out of prison and reunite them with their family is a seminal moment in their life. It imprints our lives. It's a happy moment. But when the lights of the media's cameras die down and people stop, you know, trying to get interviews with them, they have to get on with their lives, and it's hard. And it's hard because they haven't had to have, you know, normal relationships with people on the outside because they've been locked up. Most of their, you know, adult existence has been, the unifying theory of it has been struggling against something, and now you're out and you don't really have to have conflict and struggle, but that defines oftentimes the relationships with people on the outside and creates difficulty having, you know, relationships and significant others. You know, you get out and you've been incarcerated for a murder, let's say, that you didn't commit, and even though you're absolutely innocent and people intellectually know you're innocent, there's still a stigma of having been in prison for a very long time for a very terrible crime that people can't shake. People don't want to hire you just because you've been in prison, even though you're absolutely innocent. You might have been innocent of a rape, but women sometimes at the store that you want to get a job at don't want to work with you because they're still afraid of you. And that's something I don't know how to overcome that. But what I do know is that as a society, the more we sensitize ourselves to the phenomena of wrongful convictions and we admit that it exists, and we understand how it all works, and what we can understand what we need to do to try to help these individuals reintegrate back into society and know that even though it's a little uncomfortable, sometimes we need to take chances on people who have been in prison. It's important for us to do because as a society, they were incarcerated in our names, and it's the least that we owe them to give them chances to succeed after they're exonerated.
And your cases can sometimes take years, 4, 5, 6 years, yeah, to have. And that's a tremendous amount of time and commitment. Can you describe the relationships that you end up developing with them, with their families over time?
Yeah, this is sort of the unintended consequence that I didn't think about when I got into this work. When you have a family member of a client calling you once a week for 10 years to ask how their family member's case is going, you get to know people really well. When I see my clients once a month and talk to them on the phone, we talk about more than just their cases. We talk about how they're feeling, the struggles that they're having, maintaining positive relationships inside and outside the prison. You get to know them as people. And I think that is maybe the greatest thing about my work, is understanding that, you know, we have these terrible views of people who are in prison, but ultimately they're just people. The people who are there guilty, they may have done bad things, but they're not, they're who they are as a person is not defined by what they did on their worst day. I mean, they're just human beings who might have made mistakes. And in the case of my clients, they're people who we've made out to be monsters who aren't even monsters. They're actually innocent. So it's had a humanizing force for me and the other people who do this work to be able to create those relationships. And actually, it helps me do my job better. It helps me always stay clear about what our goal is, which is to do whatever we can to get this person out of prison, to give them their life back. It helps me stay energized and invigorated to do this work. So while it's difficult, particularly when we lose, and I have to tell someone that we're at the end of the road and they may die in prison, and that is terrible and difficult, it keeps me hyper-focused on what our goals are, which is to right an injustice for this individual.
How do you know that you're not working to get someone exonerated who actually did commit the crime?
Well, first and foremost, in terms of you know, how do you know that you're not working on behalf of a guilty person? You don't know. However, the system fixes that, I feel like. When we're doing DNA testing in the case, the science doesn't lie. So the science, there's no silver bullets in that science. And we always tell people when we take their cases on, look, your case is a good DNA testing case. It can prove you innocent, but it can also prove you guilty. Do you want us to do this? And we have confirmed guilt in more cases than we've proved innocence. And that's okay. We feel like that is a good public function. We're letting people know that at least in some cases, we get it right. So in many respects, I feel like the system prevents us from doing that. And it's a function of how hard it is to overturn a wrongful conviction. I've had many, many, many more cases where I have good, solid evidence of innocence, and we still are not able to overturn that person's conviction and exonerate them. And that's because the system is designed not to free innocent people who are wrongfully convicted, but instead to preserve their convictions regardless of whether they're innocent or not.
How many people have you been able to free?
My project has been responsible for overturning 18 wrongful convictions. We've gotten 16 of those people out, and we're still awaiting two more that we've overturned the convictions this year to get them out. They're still in prison.
So what kind of child grows up to do this kind of work? And talk a little bit about your, you know, your path to this position.
Yeah, you know, I was, you know, I don't have a lot of injustice in my life. I was a kid who grew up in a fairly privileged suburban background, went to Penn State, which is a fairly homogenous community, didn't see a lot of injustice. But I will say that, you know, I'm a grandchild of Holocaust survivors, so I do have maybe an innate sense of what it means to be persecuted. And so I think, you know, through that lens, it allows me to have a window into what people from marginalized and vulnerable communities in this country are experiencing, not because I know it, because I don't, but it allows me to listen, not, you know, not say, oh, you don't know what you're talking about, but just listen to folks' lived experience, not so I can tell them whether they're right or wrong, but so I can learn from it. And that helps me do my job better. It's just listening a lot.
I've heard you talk about there being an evolution of the way that society views wrongful convictions and has, you know, maybe over the past 30 or 40 years. Can you talk about that shift?
Yeah. The shift in how people view or accept the idea that wrongful convictions happen is it came by necessity, right? At some point when you get so many people out of prison, you have to accept that this is something that happens and it's a real thing we have to address. And the funny thing is, when we get someone out of prison, it's like hardly a news story anymore. It's de rigueur, right? It's happening so often that it's hard to sort of cut through and get people to realize that it's happening so often. So that's sort of an unintended effect of having so much success. But you can see when you have Innocence Project attorneys and prosecutors and law enforcement getting together to do trainings run by the Department of Justice on how to prevent wrongful convictions, you know we've come a long way in doing this work. And that's been largely predicated on the great work of my colleagues around the country to change the way we view the criminal justice system.
Well, and you talked about the, I mean, in mentioning that there's a lot of media coverage, there are podcasts, there's, you know, documentary series about wrongful convictions and things like that. But what do you think we miss when we have these conversations, especially because you're doing this work every day? What do we not quite understand?
You know, the documentaries like Making a Murderer and Serial podcast have been huge and immensely helpful to bringing this niche issue to the masses. When you have 10 million people in this country who are binge watching Making a Murderer, that's a big deal. And, you know, people understanding that, oh my gosh, people falsely confessed to crimes they didn't commit. Again, that's really big. What people don't see, even in those documentaries that are long form, they don't see all of the work that goes in for a decade or more to write a wrongful conviction, the money that it takes to do it. And I always say that, you know, exonerating someone is like moving a mountain. That's what it takes. you know, it's just something that people don't see, the grind that we go through every day to right miscarriage of justice.
So I don't know any head of any nonprofit who just gets to do the work of the nonprofit. You know, I would imagine that fundraising is a huge part of what you do. Talk a little bit about how you balance the attorney working on cases side with the real work of being able to do this work, which is getting funds to do it.
So I consider the fundraising the real work of what we need to do because I'm passionate about it and I advocate, you know, to people who I want to contribute to our organization the same way that I advocate in court with passion and verve because I care about this work. It's a necessary component of doing the work is raising the funds that allow you to do it and provide high quality legal assistance to your clients.
So you've been doing this work for a while now?
For a while. As a student, I started 15 years ago doing it and then since 2006 as a lawyer, yeah.
What keeps you motivated? What allows you to continue to do this work every day?
You know, I have a 5-year-old son, and you know, again, he's growing up like I did in a fairly privileged background. But I want him to be able to see the world in an empathetic way. I want him to know that not everything is always at his seams, and he shouldn't prejudge people. And I want to show him by example that when you see something wrong, when you see an injustice, you have to right it. You have to do whatever you can to right it, even if it's hard, even if it's uncomfortable, because it's the right thing to do. You can't shy away from it. And so I think if you asked any of my colleagues with kids, they'd tell you the same thing. We live for our children. And so in this case, we work for our children as well.
Seth Miller, thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Seth Miller is the executive director of the Innocence Project of Florida, a nonprofit that aims to free wrongfully convicted and incarcerated people. He is also president of the Innocence Network, a collection of more than 70 innocence organizations around the world. Miller previously served as an attorney with the American Bar Association Death Penalty Moratorium Implementation Project and with the First District Court of Appeal in Tallahassee, Florida. He graduated from the Florida State University College of Law and received his undergraduate degree from Penn State. Hear more Take Note interviews on our website at wpsu.org/take note. I'm Shireen Stanford, WPSU.